This is London calling North America. Next in this transmission will be a short talk by Dave Driscoll of station WOR New York, which will be rebroadcast by that station. Stand by for Dave Driscoll. This is Dave Driscoll calling WOR from BBC London. I think it best that I call this a letter from Britain. A radio letter, as it were, for a visitor to the United Kingdom gets many impressions during even such a short stay as 2 weeks. These, then, are reactions in Britain, 1947. When a liner such as the America of the United States lines docks at Southampton, the passengers crowd the rails just as they did before the war. Quite a number are American businessmen making their second or third voyage since the end of hostilities. Many others are Americans who are on their way to visit relatives that they have not seen since before the war. The businessmen are laden with food packages as gifts for their associates on this side. The others are likewise burdened with bundles, packages, suitcases, and even trunks of clothing, food, and other necessities for their appreciative friends and relatives. It isn't a matter of wondering what it's going to be like when you land. You have some idea of what it's going to be like. You've been warned in advance that food is scarce, transportation difficult. The debarkation process is the same as always. Your luggage is piled on racks for customs inspection. A few yards away, the ancient boat train awaits the passengers as soon as the inspectors have finished with them. The immigration and finance control men have seen you before you or anyone else is permitted to leave the ship. Americans are permitted to bring ashore not more than 20 pounds, which at the official rate of exchange is $80. 20 pounds, however, can be purchased legally in New York for $60 or less because of the devaluation of British money. The Englishman coming ashore rarely has a pound left in his pocket because he was permitted to take so few out of the country in the first place. Often he has a friend meet him at the dock with additional funds. Once through the formalities, you settle down in a seat on the boat train. No one laughs at the appearance of the train. Americans are somewhat taken aback. The British know the old relic and know it'll be a long time before there's a new one. The interior is Victorian and musty. There's an odor about the car like that which comes from old furniture and storage. Finally, the train begins its two-hour run to Waterloo Station in London. And as it pulls away from the shed covering the dock, we can see some of the bomb damage. The place has been tidied up so that many of the scars, however, go unnoticed. Soon we are skirting the city and are struck by the gardens. Every little house has a garden, front, side, and rear. Much of the place, almost all of it, is planted to vegetables, and suddenly you realize again how tight the food situation really is. The sun is high, although it's still after 6 o'clock as the train clatters through the lush English countryside. The fields are neatly cultivated and the wheat and oats are still green, for the growing season is far behind that at home. It was particularly late this year because of the spring floods, and the grain crop looks poor compared to ours in America. Soon you are in London, and a Cockney porter puts your luggage on a handcart and races for the taxi stand to try and get at the head of the line of passengers coming from your train. Well, this is the American's first contact with the queue, as lines are called over here. You climb into a tiny and ancient taxi that is 10 or 12 years old, but which runs like a well-oiled watch, and start across the Waterloo Bridge, craning your neck out of the window to get the first good look at the city. The first building I recognized was St. Paul's, off to my right. I think the British would like to know that, for the cathedral has been given even greater significance as a symbol of the determination of this country to stand off the Blitz in 1940. It stands majestically amid the burned-out blocks of the old city, one bomb hole in the back of its altar, which is now being repaired. You, of course, have made your hotel reservations far in advance and are soon making yourself comfortable. In a few days, you begin to get your feet on the ground well enough to make some observations about conditions here. England is like an engine that is on dead center. The chaotic downward spiral caused by the war has been checked, at least for the moment, as it applies to the little man. It is still on for the wealthy, although they seem to do well enough indeed. But while some progress is being made, according to the socialist labor government claims, the country has so far to go forward, the present progress, if there really is any, doesn't show itself to the visitor, nor to a good many of the British. Whether the engine of progress, which now seems to be on dead center, will eventually go forward to success or reverse itself and go backward to greater economic difficulties is the big question. The present labor government has been in power 2 years. Its efforts cannot be anything but sincere, for it must know this is its greatest opportunity. If it fails, it will surely go down and may never come back. Just as there is constant criticism at home between Democrats and Republicans, so there is a steady bickering here between laborites and conservatives. Some of the debates in Parliament are very bitter, perhaps more so than they are at home in Congress. And just as at home, the debates are most bitter on subjects of domestic affairs. The matter of fuel supply is always being brought up, for the coal shortage last winter brought about terrible suffering among the people, and none wants to see it repeated. The government insists coal production is coming along in good shape, with the output over that of last year. However, the opposition insists just as firmly that production isn't up enough to stave off another bad experience during the coming winter months. The miners are on a 5-day week, just about the only labor group in England that is. And there's much argument about increased rather than decreased absenteeism. Well, these are matters about which the British know more than the American visitor. However, it is obvious, even to the uninitiated, that it will be a long time before Britain can export coal in any significant quantities. And that, of course, is the big quantitative problem. Already, British exports and other items are well above the 1938 level. But economically, it is not enough. Coal has always been one of the nation's principal exports. Before the war, coal was called black dollars over here. So there must be increasing exports to obtain the purchasing power to import the things British must have. Britons are constantly reminded of the economic struggle ahead. Big posters are to be seen in various sections of each community warning, "We work or we want." Regent Street in London, which with Bond Street makes up the city's shopping center, the Englishman's Fifth and Madison Avenues, is presently decorated with flags and pennants, all calling attention to the need to export. Sort of telling the customers that they should buy on Regent Street, but if they cannot buy many of the things displayed in the shop windows, well, they should understand everything that is not absolutely essential is going out of the country to bring dollars back in. Incidentally, what can be purchased locally is extremely high-priced and equally high in coupon value. Full-fashioned ladies' hose are tagged at 3 coupons each, and Madame here has but 48 coupons a year for all her clothing needs. The British refer to the need for dollars as the dollar squeeze. It isn't that the United States is putting the squeeze on, but that the British themselves are in a balance of trade squeeze that is a result of not exporting for the 7-year period of the war. This has brought about a condition where every man and woman is asked to put forth the effort of a Hercules during the next 2 years to break the tightening circle about Britain. To appreciate what this recent government request to the people means, one must remember this was the front line during a 6-year battle. Many English with whom I've talked have indicated that the strain is beginning to tell on them. There's a futility about it all. On the other hand, there are others who say sincerely the man in this country does not work to bring about great happiness for himself in his present lifespan, but bears down and works hard to see that things will be better after he's gone. One thing seems quite certain, however, and that is that the average person here has come to regard the United States as the great power to whom this country must look for guidance. That is not in loans of dollars particularly, but guidance in world affairs. Leadership. No longer does the Briton feel that Britannia rules the waves and the world. He hopes the United States will soon realize the dominant position it has and take the ball and run with it. The longer one stays here, the more apparent that conclusion becomes. There's not much talk of a third world war in Britain, and some here are perplexed why we at home seem so, well, concerned about it. There is a feeling which is not too readily expressed, however, that such trouble does actually lie ahead. When pressed on the matter, a Britisher is quite likely to say he thinks the United States will have to take the lead in the next one. We will come along with you, of course, but we can't do the slogging alone at the start as we have in the last 2, he may say. Now a word about the housing situation. We all know what it is at home. Here in Britain, it is 20 times as bad. The same basic reasons prevail here, plus the fact that thousands of homes were completely destroyed or damaged beyond immediate repair. As one travels about the country here and there, he sees new homes going up, but not in sufficient quantity to make much effect. Labor, with regard to housing, is causing much argument and comment. As you know, traditional British construction is of brick. Well, it seems the brick factories have turned out brick much faster than it was used, and in some instances, production has to be curtailed. 1947 bricklayers here are not laying brick as fast as they did in pre-war times. And there's a strong movement afoot to put construction labor on a piecework basis. That is, so much for so many bricks laid per day, rather than on the average wage scale, which is in current effect. Labor, naturally, is fighting the movement very vigorously, and so housing remains a tremendous problem, and will continue to be one for perhaps 10 years. About food, no one in Britain is starving, but when one sees what the average citizen is up against, he realizes that American food shortages, such as they were nothing compared to the situation over here. It is quite beyond imagination by American standards in this day and age. We've all heard about the low meat ration, each person receiving the equivalent of about one mutton chop a week. But what one does not understand at home, I believe, is how little else there is. There is a terrible monotony in eating in Britain. It has become a matter of filling the stomach and warding off hunger. There is little pleasure in it because there is no variety. And to the housewife, every meal is a difficult job. She has to queue up or line up for all of the essentials. It's surprising there isn't more grumbling. Oh, there's plenty, but it's not too serious at the moment. After what these people have gone through since 1939, they feel, I think, they're in the home stretch of their difficulties, although the finish line is nowhere in sight. But it is no secret the housewife is getting tired of struggling so hard to make a meal for her husband and family. It is even a problem in the country districts, where one might expect a little more food because it's grown there. However, there are severe restrictions on what the farmer can do with the produce he raises. I have wondered many times whether the housewife thinks she will ever live to see the day when she will not have to queue up, the day when she can go out and buy the things we take as commonplace. Every American home has a cupboard full of all the things it takes to whip up a tasty supper out of leftovers: cooking oil, sauces, butter, frozen foods, and 100 other items. Well, there are no leftovers over here, and there is practically nothing tasty to start with. People are living on starches, potatoes, cabbage, cauliflower. Ice cream is misnamed now. It might better be called iced starch. In almost 2 weeks here, we've had roast beef at once. That was in Scotland, and a wheat piece it was, too. Thus, it can be seen how important food packages from America are to these people. The food package is the difference between one good meal now and then or the missing link, which is inevitable under the present ration system and shortages. And now to close this radio letter from Britain, let me say it's a small world at that. Standing at the edge of a park in Edinburgh the other evening, watching the dancing on the mall, we struck up a conversation with a charming old gentleman. It took but a few sentences on our part for him to realize we were Americans. "I used to work in America," he said. "I worked at the Mattituck Hotel at Mattituck on Long Island." "Mattituck? Why, that's 5 miles from our summer place," we said in unison. The old man had been gone from there for 20 years, so we brought him up to date in the long Scottish twilight that does not bring darkness until almost midnight. This is Dave Driscoll saying, sincerely yours.
This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.
That was Dave Driscoll speaking from London to station WOR, New York.